Okay then, so phishing. I'm going to be talking about phishing fraud and the new cybercrime that we're seeing, and this time it's real. I'm Philip Palenbaker, and the principal scientist of VeriSign. Some of you are probably thinking that we're a security company. Actually, we're not. We're just a company that happens to run a couple of infrastructures that have some security issues. And so, although what I'm going to be describing today is work that we've been done on the tracking down criminals and stopping them side, I don't want you to get the idea that that's our objective, to create a business keeping the problem going. Really, our interest is stopping this because the phishing crime is hurting our business. And in particular, phishing crime is destroying trust in the internet, and that is hurting the digital economy, and that hurts my company. So phishing, what's going on? Well, I think we need to look back 20 years. 20 years ago, hacking was the MIT hacker culture. It was sticking a police cruiser on the Great Dome. It was fun, it was pranks, it was amusement. About the 1990s, things changed and people got the idea that hacking, well, it was basically vandalism. You'd get into a website and you would mess it all up. And when I came into the internet security world, I was expecting that what I was going to be doing was tracing down people who were trying to steal money. And then I spent 10 years trying to stop vandalism. The vandals, they're mostly attention-seeking, they're mostly looking for bragging rights, and they're juvenile delinquents. So, typical attack, social engineering of journalists, saying, hey, we're really smart. And a lot of the journalists bought it, unfortunately. Usually malicious. Sometimes it was monetary gain, but really what was powering it was looking for the bragging rights. And then now, I think in retrospect, we've got to think of 2000 as the year that internet crime turned serious, internet crime turned pro. And what I think has happened is, in part, the juvenile delinquents of 10 years ago have grown up. And what happens to juvenile delinquents when they grow up? Well, some of them get honest jobs, and a small number don't. And they turn to their crime as a means of supporting their family, and so they turn professional. I think that that might be part of what is behind the dramatic shift that we've seen from internet crime being vandalism to now it being for money. So we've got spam, which I've regarded as the true face of cybercrime for a very long time. Most spam now is just outright criminal. There is no legitimate product at the other end. It's a scam. And the worst tactic that we've seen in recent times is this epidemic of phishing. They send out an email that pretends to come from a bank, a well-known bank, or a financial payment transfer service, and it says, protect your security. Enter your credit card number into this site. And the thing is that the way that these things are set up, unless you know what is going on, they can be very convincing. They look just like they came from the real company they're impersonating. And they're saying, oh, scary, security, be safe. Go to this site and enter your username and password. Go to this site and enter your credit card number. And it doesn't work all the time, but it's been working an awful lot more than their spam has been working. And the problem from the point of view of the banks is that they have a direct loss, but they also have a much bigger potential loss, and that is that they've spent the past 10 years investing billions of dollars in internet banking technology. If they can no longer persuade their customers that that technology is safe, that investment will be lost, and they will be left with the result of their customers now expect that 24/7 internet banking convenience, but they can't use that internet infrastructure to support it. So a dramatic rise in costs and an expectation gap. So they don't want to go back. So this raises the question. We've been talking about internet security now for 10 years, 20 years, and we're still waiting. The internet's not secure. Why? Well, one reason is you can't solve the problem with a 20-year-old map. If you go to the ITF, you'll hear people talking about end-to-end security as if it was the Holy Grail. There's only one small problem with end-to-end security. Most real users can't use it. And even if they could use it, in real enterprises, there's a border. And in a real enterprise, I don't want my secrets going out through the border, encrypted. I need to be able to see them. And so, what we've been seeing is security for geeks, security for geek security concerns. It's all been about personal control and not about providing security infrastructures that meet an enterprise need or meet the needs of non-technical, naive users whose first aim in life is not going to be to work out the fundamentals of the Unix grep command. We can't solve this problem with a 10-year-old map either. Perimeter security has been the most successful strategy for enterprise security to date. However, as the keynote this conference showed, that strategy is reaching its logical limits. There's only so much you can do at the borders. Border security is useful. The guy on the reception desk, the security guard at your door, has a real, live, useful function. But that guy is not going to be the solution to all your security needs. You need to go further. And so we need to think beyond the perimeter security model. What I would like to go towards is ideology-free security, so that instead of saying, we're going to work from this map that was drawn 10 years ago, we secure the internet, then we draw the map. At the moment, we are in that place that says, here be dragons. We've got to slay the dragons before we can draw the map. So security has to be redefined as risk management. It's not meeting a standard. It's not meeting a SAS 70 audit. And security in depth mustn't just become another dogma. If we do that, then security in depth will fail just the same way as end-to-end has failed and just the same way as perimeter has failed. So what's phishing going on? Well, the bad guys have two choices. They can bash their heads against the steel walls of internet security systems that have been constructed for banks at the cost of millions of dollars, state-of-the-art equipment, or they can take the easy route. They can attack the weakest link in the chain, and the weakest link is the consumer. So I was talking to one of my banking customers recently, and they were saying, well, we always expected them to go after us, and so we protected ourselves. Now they're going after our customers, and we discover that that is worse. And the thing is that this approach is turning out to work rather too often. I've not got recent figures, but people have been saying 3% of the phishing emails that are opened are responded to. That's dramatically higher than the number that are responded to in the case of a spam advertisement. So what's real cybercrime? What does it look like? We've got the stealing of credentials, the phishing. Credit card numbers, bank username, password, social security number. Some of the times they'll just collect information so that they can then apply for a credit card number on your behalf. There's a second part to this scam, and that is using the stolen credentials. There'd be no point in stealing them if you couldn't use them. And that has been the hard part to date. So this uptick in the phishing crime may represent an uptick in the technology used to do the carding. Support functions. There's evidence that there are specialists who just steal machines all day and then retail the machines on to a phishing gang. In some cases, there's evidence that maybe they are renting space on their botnet to one gang, and then, after a while, renting space to another gang. Just for the sake of completeness, there are some other scams out there. You've probably heard of advance fee fraud. These are these 419 scams, mostly coming out of Nigeria, which is where the principal gangs are based. And this is a very old fraud. Actually, when you start to look at cybercrime, it's all old. The phishing fraud I've been describing, that's been going on for 50 years. It used to be the waitress in the wet restaurant who would write down a copy of your credit card number when you handed over the card. Today, they use the phishing impersonation attack. This advance fee fraud goes back all the way to the Crusades, when a knight was captured and needed ransoming, and your liege lord would be very pleased and very well rewarded if he'd only help pay to help get the ransom transported. And then a series of problems would come up, and those would require some money to be forwarding. There's a new variant of this scam. It involves fake cashier's checks, and one of the messages that the naive using public needs to be told is, actually a cashier's check can be voided after it has been cashed. If it's a fake instrument, the bank can cancel the transaction after a certain amount of time. So what these gangs do is they find somebody on eBay selling something relatively expensive. They send them a cashier's check for the $3,000, $10,000, whatever, and say, oh, $300, $3,000, that needs to go to the shipping office or some other really great excuse that they've got. And so the mark cashes the check, waits for the funds to clear. After they've cleared, they think they're safe, they forward the money on, and it goes off to Nigeria. Extortion and protection rackets. Actually, there was a 419 scam that went out recently that was kind of like Murder, Inc. We will kill you unless you forward money to us. The extortion and protection rackets tend to be more of the form of group of hackers crack some company's website and then appear, oh, we're consultants. We can solve your problem. And this is just the old protection racket again. So I'd like to make an observation here, and that is that fraud must now be considered an acceptable hypothesis. Over the past 10 years, we've been training ourselves to say, hey, let's think of the simpler solution. The simpler solution is the vandalism. Well, this real cybercrime is real now. If we'd have been thinking that the spam, if we'd been thinking of the criminal hypothesis earlier, maybe we'd have realized what the spam really was much sooner. One of the problems has been is that we've been thinking of cybercrime as something sexy, something that Sherlock Holmes would really like to have investigated, you know, breaking into international banks. And when you come down to it, no, it's stupid, it's brutal, but it's also effective. And so this is the real cybercrime going after your weakest links. We know that there are professional criminals. We know that the Nigerian gangs are organized crime. We know that the phishing scams come from organized scams. We know that there must be organized crime of a significant scale involved in the internet. So if you're looking at a problem, don't be afraid to think of, maybe they're going after the money. They may be making it look like vandalism, but maybe they're going after the money. And if you're not alert to that fact, well, maybe you're not going to get what's really going on. So there's some good news here in that the vandalisms looked for novelty. And one of the big problems about tracking down the vandals was that as soon as they got good at a crime, well, they stopped doing it. It was hard. professional criminals have a single objective, money, and they're going to keep repeating the same crime with the same tools again and again and again until either it stops making them money or they get caught. This means that we have a modus operandi. This means that traditional law enforcement techniques can now be effective. Because traditional law enforcement, it's all about the modus operandi, it's all about the repeated crime again and again and again. Following the money works. And the other thing is that when I suggest security measures and people say, oh, they'll get around that. Well, there's actually a significant value in forcing the bad guys to change what they're doing. Because each time you force them to change what they're doing, you're forcing their tools out of the groove that they've been running in. You force the criminal to adapt. And these criminals tend to be rather lazy about adapting. If these people were complete finisher types, they'd have a real job. So putting the pressure on the criminals, forcing them to keep changing, that increases the probability of them making a mistake. When the Millennium plot to bomb Los Angeles airport in the eve of the Millennium was foiled, it was foiled because a couple of customs agents got suspicious at a border. That was not complete random chance. The authorities got lucky, but they had made their own luck because they had put all the borders on high alert. They'd said, look out for people who look like this, who may be up to something bad. There is some plot in the works. We don't know what it is. So putting the pressure on the criminals really works. You make your own luck. So phishing tactics. One tactic, you can set up a merchant site. Sorry, you can hack a merchant site. They've been taking credit card numbers for buying CDs. Hack in there, take the database of credit card numbers, run off with it. This is the reason why the credit card companies have been coming down very hard on merchants who keep unencrypted databases of credit cards lying around. This was the original purpose of the Secure Electronic Transactions, SET protocol. Second way you can do it is you compose as a merchant. This again is a long-standing real-world attack. There are fake merchants who rent a shop, they start taking in mail order business, they run a few goods through the front door, and then after the business has grown up to a certain level, they take in a massive number of orders with a big, big advertising promotion, and then they disappear. Well, the same scam appears in cyberspace. This is the real scam that the SSL certificate is designed to avoid. The idea of those authentication procedures you need to go through to get an SSL certificate is to stop you from performing this type of scam. Now, spam filtering may have made it unprofitable to send out messages saying, you know, the various potions and pills to increase or decrease various parts of your anatomy. At this point, the response rate for spam, well, it was less than 1 in 100,000 a year ago. I have to believe that as the spam has increased, the response rate must have declined. So now, they're forced into new tactics, pretending to be a trusted brand, impersonating banks, impersonating well-known trusted payment protocols. It's risky, but it's profitable. It's risky because you send out a message pretending to be one of the top 10 global banks. You've got the undivided attention of a very large, very well-financed, very well-resourced organization who's going to make it their business to put you out of business. And this is one that we've been seeing on a very small scale, going after very, very higher-end customers of private banks, and that is trojaning a machine, loading spyware onto a consumer machine, and then monitoring the keystrokes so that when they go off to their private bank to make a transfer of $500,000 from A to B, they can send it somewhere else. The customers of one of those banks recently complained to me, well, the problem with them is you can't make a transfer of more than $999,000. And I was thinking, it's a sad life. So what's going on in one of these phishing attacks? Well, you have three basic components. You have capture sites, you have some means of advertising the capture sites, and you've got a means of covering your tracks. This crime is all about covering your tracks because it's really easy to get caught. As soon as you do that, as soon as you send out one of these attacks, you're going to have the undivided attention of whoever you're impersonating. And those people tend to have a very good way of getting the undivided attention of the Secret Service or the FBI. So here's a model of a phishing attack. We have a perpetrator, we have victims, and we have a capture site. The perpetrator insulates themselves from the victims by means of what I call anonymous hosts and what you may know as zombies or a botnet. Every communication between the perpetrator and the crime is insulated by at least two levels of indirection. Sometimes when we trace it down, it can go real, real long. The first thing the perpetrator is going to do is to prepare by putting some materials out onto a capture site that they have suborned. Then they're going to send out a spam advertisement to a series of victims. These can go out in the millions. The victim is socially engineered, reveals their data to the capture site, and then there's got to be some means of recovering the data. Quite often, the bad guys are using email accounts at web-hosted email services in the US as part of this track. The reason why they do this is that email is subject to certain privacy restrictions, so you have to go off and get a subpoena before you can get that information. It introduces delay, and by the time that you've got the subpoena, they've gone. So a phishing attack timeline, they start their preparation. Some days later, they start the attack. A few minutes after the attack is launched, it's discovered. One of the ways that you can discover a phishing attack trying to impersonate you is if you monitor your bounce mail. Because most of these phishing attacks go out pretending to come from your address. So if you're anybank.com, they will come with a from address of anybank.com. They want to tell the user it's safe, it's all right. So when this message comes saying from anybank.com, they send out 10 million of them. There's going to be a backwash against your server. And even if they sent the bounce address differently, SMTP, there's a bounce address that you can set to send the bounces elsewhere. Even if they do that, you will be getting something like 2% of the mail that was sent out bouncing at you. So when I talk to my customers, they're saying, well, we knew that something bad was going on when we got 30,000 bounce emails coming at us and we hadn't sent out any mail. So the time from the start of attack to the discovery at the moment is about 30 minutes on average. We're looking into technology to try and shrink that. But that has been less of a priority because until we started doing this takedown thing, the time from the discovery to the takedown of the capture site was measured in days. This is a hard task because the bad guys try and make it as hard as possible. I'll come to that later. And then after the bad guy's site has been taken down, they reload, they go again. We've found capture sites and we've found spam sending sites preloaded with 4 or 5 attacks. So that after the attack bank A, they can go to bank B, bank C, bank D, all prepared, all ready to go. So, I mentioned the bounce address issue and the monitoring your bounce mail to see one of these attacks. People say, well, they'll just send them from some other address. Well, this is an analysis of 500 phishing emails that were sent in the first half of 2004, and 93% of them spoofed the legitimate email address of the target. So, at the moment, monitoring your bounce mail is a very, very effective way of finding out if one of these things is going on. That may change in the future, but at the moment, it's very effective. In 2% of the cases, they use what we call a cousin address. A recent attack that I was investigating, the real website and the spoof one differed only by the fact that the real website had no hyphen and the spoofed one had a hyphen in it. So you'd have to be very alert not to be fooled. So those are the cousin addresses. And in 5%, they just come from random addresses on the internet. Location of the capture sites. Large number in the US. This is probably reflecting the fact that the US is where most of the broadband connections are. And you really need to have your capture site hosted somewhere with a broadband connection. 10% in Korea. Again, very large amount of broadband in Korea. The rest of Asia, however, Asia seems to be a very favorite place for hosting phishing capture sites if the attackers happen, if they're attacking a bank based in the US. One of the reasons for that is time zones. I'll come to that. The reason why you want to attack with someone in Asia is those places, it's their close of business at the same time that it's our close of business. The phishing attacks tend to go out after 8 o'clock Eastern time. So after close of business on the West Coast. They go till about 4 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, and there's a small dribble throughout the rest of the day. What they're doing here is they're waiting till the people who might respond have closed. And in particular, they're waiting until the people who might be at the ISP have gone home for the day. If you think of this in terms of the time in Asia, well, they're attacking at roughly 4 o'clock in the morning. That's a time of day that it's very hard to get in touch with system administrators at ISPs. In fact, one of our recent cases, the capture site was located on a machine in a schoolroom in Korea, and it was out of turn. So there's nobody in the school at all. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and they don't speak English. It's rather hard to get a site taken down. So this is the reason why we've been roped into this, because we have affiliates all over the world and we can get somebody who speaks the language. Phishing attacks by days of the week. I don't know if this is showing up. Basically, Monday through Sunday, it's basically 14-15% most days of the week, apart from Saturday. Saturday is 10%. And that is a statistically significant drop in the rate of the attacks. So I don't know what the reason for this would be. One explanation would be these guys like to take the weekend off. And, you know, Friday night's their night on the town. So they don't send them out on Saturday. Okay, a case study. This took place in March 2004. There were some attacks leading up to this, but the preparation for this particular one started at 4 o'clock Pacific. They suborned an anonymous host in Tacoma, Washington. It was an unprotected FTP share. They rootkitted the server, created new logins in case they got thrown out, set up the capture site. It wasn't linked to the main site on the machine. They didn't use cousin domains. And then they used a standard Perl mailer to just send out about 100,000 fraudulent adverts. They started the attack 5 hours later. at 9:17 a.m. Pacific. This particular target, the nature of their business was such that they decided to attack during the hours of business, which was kind of convenient for us because it meant that, you know, it was, actually it's 24 hours, so maybe it wasn't that convenient. So they sent out a fraudulent advert to the customers, and they, as soon as they sent out the fraudulent ad, they cover their tracks by deleting all the information on the mailing list. It's discovered 25 minutes later. This is not a tier 1 target or even a tier 2 target for phishing attack. In fact, when we went in to analyze the attack, it was kind of goofy because we couldn't work out how you could monetize the usernames and passwords they stole. Became aware of the scam 25 minutes after the attacks launched. They were linking to a lookalike login page, looked just like the standard login, username and password phishing. Taken down 9:47. This time we got really lucky because we'd had two previous incidents involving the ISP where the capture site was hosted. First attempt was via the ARIN abuse at contacts. This only got the voicemail. We used the golden Rolodex. We got in touch with a live person, and 5 minutes later, the site is down. Sometimes you get the site down, and the person who's been hacked takes the site down, deletes it from the machine completely, reboots the machine. 5 minutes later, the site is back up again because the bad guys have left a back door. And as soon as the site comes down, they pull it back up again. The reason why they have to do this is once you've got this sent out all that spam advertising your phishing fraud, everybody who's received that spam is trying to go to a particular machine in the internet or a particular domain name in the internet. And if that is broken, all those people who have been socially engineered will be much harder to convince a second time. So part of the issue for the bad guys is keeping their capture sites up is vital if it's going to be an economic attack for them. And then we did the forensics. We pulled the FTP logs of the target ISP. They were very helpful with us. And this showed that they used three IP addresses to attack the host. Two of them in Romania, one in Spain. We can't really assume from this that the attack comes from Romania, but... Well, that's a good question. So the question is, could we sniff the traffic and watch the attack in progress? When you have one of these attacks, what you really want to do is just slam the line down as soon as you can. As soon as we've got the problem is that we know where the data was going because we could read the scripts that they had loaded up. That was being sent to a free webmail provider. And then from there, it was being downloaded onto another machine probably. And so sniffing the connection or whatever probably wouldn't have given us useful information. But our priority was to take down the site. Because, you know, the brand target is being victimized. And we want to prevent as many names, people giving their username and passwords as possible. So, criminal value chain. This has been hypothesized for years. I think at this point, the data, the evidence for this is very, very solid, that there is something of a criminal value chain. And there are people who specialize in the zombie and the botnet acquisition and retail them to the phishing gangs and the spam gangs. There are armed supplier specialists. Some of the times that we've taken down a site, we found phishing tools on the site. And some of these phishing tools are really, really good. Like a really professional Windows GUI. So that you just give it the URL of the site that you want to phish, and it does all the rest. A recent trend has been to use JavaScript and ActiveX animations and Flash animations to cover up the address bar of the browser, so that the user is in the position of, you know, we've been telling the user, look at the address bar, make sure it's from us. And it's, oh dear. And another one that came out recently, they take you to the real bank site that's being attacked, and the login screen comes up on a pop-up window. So I think the answer to that is killing pop-ups. Anybody kill pop-ups? So, and then there's the carding gangs. And the carding gangs have not been given as much attention as I would like. It's the other half of the phishing fraud. It's the hard part. So using the stolen credentials, this is the risky part of the process, because you're going up against 50 years of experience on the part of the card company's fraud departments. The law enforcement know how to deal with this scam. The fraud prevention mechanisms are in place to allow bogus purchases to be traced. And if you look, think of the number of credit cards that are being stolen in the phishing attacks. There'd be no point in stealing 100,000 credit cards if you hadn't worked out a way of using 100,000 credit cards. So it's the scale issue. These people aren't using these credit cards in onesie twosies. They've worked out a way that they can use 100, 200 stolen credit cards a day. So what do? One way that they do it is that they create fake credit cards. Some of them can look really good. These are then sold on to petty criminals. And there are tours that come out from Eastern Europe and hit the shops in Germany, buy lots of stuff and go with the stolen cards and then go back. This is actually a very risky way of using the credentials, because, you know, it's got to be an in-person transaction. So, you know, they're using students, folk who are disposable, but, you know, it takes time. It's not very scalable. Another way that they're trying to do it is using the stolen cards to buy stuff online. Or they'll do a money transfer. So how do you do this without being caught? You know, how do you convert the goods into cash? How do you take delivery? You know, these people are stealing so much stuff. You know, they're not using 50 cameras themselves. They're not using 200 computers. They have to be selling them. They have to be turning them into cash. So what's going on? Well, this is the second part of the fraud, and this is work-at-home fraud. Package reshipping. They recruit a delivery agent who accepts delivery of stolen goods. They then forward the goods to the carding ring using an international shipper. And one of the messages that we're trying to get out there is that there is no legitimate job that looks like this. Package reshipping, there is not a legitimate job. Another one is money laundering, and here the people are recruited as finance directors or finance specialists. I mean, the titles that they give these people are really, really good. So they accept the money into their personal bank account, then forward the money to the ring after the transactions have cleared. Only they haven't cleared, because if you accept money in a fraudulent transaction, that transaction can and will be cancelled out. So basically what it comes down to is the common feature here is the recruit is being used to bypass the controls. The recruit is expendable. And they're more likely than not to get caught. There are a lot of cases being discovered. Some of them, the people have been gulled into it innocently. Some of them, you know, law enforcement are more skeptical. So recruitment. Now, who likes James Bond? Who used to watch the James Bond films? Did you ever wonder, where did the bad guys get all those people? You know, yeah, wanted. How wanted? 4,000 people to carve out the inside of a volcano. you know, or goons wanted. You know, 50 people wanted, must give life for crazed global egomaniac wanting to take over the world. I mean, you know, just how do you recruit those people? I just never could work out where it was all going. You know, do you call Spectre? Well, no. You send spam. So, work at home. All you need is a US bank account. So the spam mechanism seems to be declining in effectiveness, probably because spam is declining in effectiveness. If only one in a million spams has even been read, you know, I couldn't read all my spam. You know, every internet user now has to be filtering their spam, even if they don't use a bot, you know, even if they don't use an automatic filter, they can't be opening them all up and reading them. So it's not a recognized recruitment channel. So the people that they're getting into, some of them know what they're getting into, and they want a recruitment channel that has plausible deniability. So what do? They've been placing job adverts with legitimate job advertising agencies. This has been something that just blew up in a big way a few months ago. So a lot of efforts are underway there to spot the recruitment for Crime Inc. and shut them down as soon as possible. So there might be an element here of looking to give the recruit plausible deniability, so they say, well, I thought it was legitimate. Look at the thing that I responded to. So some cybercrime myths. I mean, as security professionals, we've been used to not being able to get attention from law enforcement, and in particular from foreign law enforcement. Well, if you're dealing with phishing crime, foreign law enforcement in most parts of the world, in fact, pretty much every part of the world, with a tiny number of exceptions where the government is practically non-existent, unless you're dealing with a failed state, the police can understand the crime, they can understand the seriousness, and they can understand that it's going to have a bad effect on their own locality. And it's also a story that looks really good in the papers in any language. Hey, we caught these cyber criminals! And the other reason why they like to go after this is that the people who are into this, this is not usually their first crime. It's not usually their second. This is just, this is kind of like venture capital, venture for organized crime. And even the corrupt police, they'll, at the very least, even if they're being paid off, they will usually tell the gang, choose somebody else. Foreign ISPs are unwilling to take action. We find that foreign ISPs are actually much more responsive than the US ISPs. When you contact US ISPs, sometimes you have, I'll have to contact legal. And they contact legal and they say, take it down immediately! What the heck do you think you're doing? I've yet to meet a lawyer who thinks it's a good idea to keep one of these phishing sites up, but there's some real thick people who get employed at ISPs. Another myth, this looks like an easy crime. What I've been trying to show you here is actually it's a very sophisticated, very subtle crime. There's a lot of moving parts. And unfortunately at the moment, the ones that we're catching are mostly the stupid ones. But the people who just try their hand at this, they mostly get caught three or four times. They don't get many outings before they get caught. So I'd like to throw out some unproven hypotheses. I mean, one of the things about cybercrime and so on is that by the time that we've got the proof to back up the hypothesis, it's old news. So that thing about the zombie and botnets, people have been talking about it and speculating it for at least 5-10 years. But we only had proof about 2 years ago. So some unproven hypotheses. You've all heard of these distributed denial of service attacks. What's the reason behind them? How could they be turned into money? Well, one reason is that they're just a way of throwing the investigators off the trail. So you attack somebody unpopular, and they say, hey, they're just trying to get those guys. We don't like those guys. Hey, oh. So maybe it's a way of throwing people off the trail so that people don't realize that the real purpose of sending out that virus was to get some zombie sites, create a botnet, and then retail it to a carding gang or phishing gang or whatever. Another possibility is what they're trying to do here is to support criminal activity. It may be direct extortion or protection threats. You know, you take out a well-known company, and then when you send out the protection letter, it's more credible. Another possibility linked to this is that increasing the general level of paranoia increases the effectiveness of the phishing attacks. This is one reason why I'm very skeptical about user education, because one of the problems is when you see these phishing emails, they all start off, "Protect yourself." Some of them even have ways of spotting a fake email written in a sidebar. And if you apply those rules, you'd know that this was a fake email. A large number of them tell you how to get in touch with the cybercrime division and so on. So we've got to be really careful about just creating fear for fear's sake, because the bad guys can turn the fear against us. Another possibility of those DDoS attacks is maybe what they're doing here is stress testing their zombie hosts before they use them in a phishing attack, particularly before they use them in a capture site. They want to know, does this have a high capacity broadband connection? Now, if you look at the back doors that are built into a lot of the bots, most of them can test that. But maybe what they're also doing is finding out whether the ISP is going to notice this zombie quickly or not. Because if the ISP is just going to shut it down after half an hour, you don't want to use it as a capture site. So these are three unproven hypotheses that I'd like to throw out there. And, you know, let's try and find some evidence and work out which ones are true and which ones aren't. And, you know, if Phil's just speculating. Okay, so the question is, could the attack be a diversion and the real victim be somewhere else? Actually, yes, I have seen them. I can't. One of my policies is that I never mention any of the subjects in any attack, whether or not we have anything to do with it, because we exchange so much data, or there might be somebody who's working on that account that I'm not aware of. So, yes, I have seen that. I mean, the problem is that I can't prove, but I do have suspicions. Not so far. I think it's probably a matter of time. Could I just finish and then have questions? I'm in my final two slides. And so what's to be done here? One thing, drain the swamp. Let's, you know, spam. We've got to stop spam, and we've got to stop it systemically. The Aspen framework. The idea of the Aspen framework is spam is due to the lack of accountability in the net. Let's put that accountability in there. Authenticate the source of the email, accredit the source of the email, so you know it's a legitimate company, you know that they don't send much spam, and consequences. You spam, nobody wants your email, or maybe there's civil penalties. Drain the swamp, viruses. I think that we've got to call time on the idea of allowing executables to move around the net in email. If people put in place virus antivirus software that checks signatures, that's an acceptable measure. We've got to tell people, if you can't do that, you've got to block all executables and your users can't send or receive them. We've got to stop the viruses from propagating. There may be evidence that the escalation in the attacks by the virus writers, you know, using the search engines with the latest tactics, that might be showing that they need to have a higher fan out and attack a larger number of sites when they infect somebody to get these things to propagate. Drain the swamp zombies. Some of you may have seen my article in CNET that got slash-dotted recently, where I was arguing for reverse firewalls. It's a shame that the piece that was cut out of that was the bit that said that this is, doesn't need to affect personal control. The idea is basically the idea of the Great Wall of China. The Great Wall of China was not to stop the bad guys from getting in. There could never be enough soldiers to man it. The idea was that the bad guys get in, and then the wall stops them getting out, because by the time the raiding party is trying to get out of the country, you've got the soldiers lining the walls and you're going to shoot whoever is trying to get out full of arrows. So the idea here was reverse firewalls, build them into every cable modem, build them into every router. Those things have loads and loads of power. What's to be done? Use credentials that can't be stolen. I think that within a short period of time, your credit card number is not going to be static. It's going to be on a dongle token type thing, and you'll press a button, and each time you press the button, you'll get a new credit card number. This is an initiative we started recently. It's a completely open standard with a whole series of manufacturers participating to make open authentication tokens. And the idea is that in the within a short period of time, the token goes away and just becomes a feature of your cell phone. So the token effectively becomes free. Pervasive security. I want to go beyond the perimeter model, but I want to have every hub, every router, every NIC performing authentication functions, performing the type of firewall functions of stopping traffic that has no business. Just one more. And then finally, improved application security. We've got to design for the real user, not the geek. New security measures are justified, but don't be afraid of saying, there's this old idea, put it to work. One of the messages of the keynote was, security is driven by business drivers. Well, a lot of good ideas have been raised in computer security before their time had come. So don't be afraid of re-raising something when you believe its time has come. And finally, ideology-free security. Let's go for incremental security, not all or nothing. Because the experience has been the market chose nothing. When you said no security was better than no security was better than bad security, well, they chose the no security and they assumed that it was good security. Bad security can be improved. I mean, you couldn't get it more wrong than WEP or SSL version 1. But those were fixed. And WEP will be a secure protocol long, long before DNSSEC or IPSEC are deployed. Secure the ends and the edge. This doesn't need to be an either-or thing. End-to-end solutions are mostly unused. And finally, security for real people, not geeks. The bad guys are going after the weakest link. And the weakest link is the user. It's your customers. And that's far worse even than them going after you. So thank you very much. Do we have any time for questions or are we out? Okay, if you want to have any questions, please see me after.